Ein Doppelcheeseburger, eine Pommes und eine Cola für 4,99? Lohnt sich das überhaupt für Macs?
All das lohnt sich für euch. Die günstigen Mac Smart Menüs jetzt schon ab 4,99 bei McDonald's. Unverbindliche Preisempfehlungen nur in teilnehmenden Restaurants.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. With me today, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford, who is back from Japan.
I am back from Japan. I survived. I had a very good time, and I guess you all survived without me.
Yes, we did. We had a very fun episode last week, I thought, with Katie and Mike, who, I mean, we needed two whole people just to fill your shoes, Nadia.
I would say I'm a high-energy person, but that's a lie.
Yeah, so... yeah, we had a great conversation about decision points in RPGs, and I really do think that y'all should go check that episode out. I'm sure that you would have been able to add plenty of interesting things on your own. Like, I was thinking about Suikoden 2, for example. I was like, oh I wish I had hit on Suikoden 2, kind of thing.
Yeah, screw up one thing, you get that just changes your whole ending, and I'm so mad that happened to me.
Yes, absolutely. And Nadia, of course, you related your adventures in Japan on the Flagship podcast, so if you want to hear a little more about that, you should go talk about it. But it sounded like you had a really good time. You got to go to Akihabara and do all that good stuff.
Yep, I did. I went to the Square Enix Cafe. I bought some junk. I bought more junk in Akihabara. It was a pretty good experience for my first time in Japan. A little overwhelming sometimes because it's just not as many people spoke English that I thought would. So, not that I mind, but I feel bad because I feel like the clerks, for example, are having a conversation with me and I can't answer and I feel so rude. But even though I know they're probably just kind of going through the routine, like, you know, saying, naming off items as they go along and, like, you know, naming out change. So, I'm not really obligated to respond, but I just feel bad that I can't.
I didn't really start to learn Japanese until I actually moved there. Because until then, it was just abstract. Like, here are some random situations or whatever. But I started to realize the rituals once I got there.
Right.
The things that people always say all the time.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
The platitudes. And once I got that, I started to get a much better feel for what the language was actually all about. Not that I can speak Japanese or anything, but at the very least, I have a fairly decent grasp on the actual rituals and things like that.
Yeah. I feel like if I had remained there a bit longer, I would have kind of been immersed in the same things. Like, I was starting to recognize what they were saying and why. So I know what you mean, by all means. But I can't remember. Why did you go there? You didn't teach in Japan, did you?
No, I totally taught in Japan.
Oh, okay. For how long?
I was there for 3 years. I lived in Tokyo. I taught for 2 years in Nova, and then Nova exploded. It went
so
supernova. And then I went over and I started writing curriculum for a company called GABA. And then I moved back here. So, yeah, that final year, 2008, which was 10 years ago point, that was my best year in Japan. And, yeah, it was a good time. I really miss
fun.
It. But, yeah, I was pretty jealous. I am a good and benevolent boss. I could have totally taken that trip myself, but I was going to send you instead because you've never been and you deserved it.
Oh, thank you. I have to say, the people I talked to were very impressed with my knowledge of the topic at hand, so that was a good thing.
Interesting, but yeah. I guess we will know more about that in the near future. In the meantime, just a few things that I wanted to highlight, because we've actually had a fairly busy week in terms of RPG coverage on the site. First is Doc Burford's Destiny 2 article.
That blew up.
Yeah, it did. Doc really knows his Destiny 2, and he was able to go super duper in depth into why exactly Destiny 2 just hasn't resonated in the same way as the original Destiny has. And the most cogent point that he seemed to make was that Destiny felt more like a sequel to Destiny 2 than the other way around, which I found pretty interesting.
That is a very interesting outlook.
And he also said, he also pointed out all the ways that Bungie, in his opinion, messed up the balancing of the the metagame and that sort of thing, and mm-hmm. what he thought the kind of the essence of Destiny actually was. And apparently Destiny players agreed with him, because there was like a thread that had like 8,000 upvotes on the Destiny subreddit, where there were a lot of people going, yes, you're totally right, you totally nailed it. So go read that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we got like pinned on the top for a while there.
The other piece is should be up around the time that this podcast goes up, which is my me recounting my epic battle with the Pink Rathian in Monster Hunter World. Oh my gosh, what an epic battle.
I didn't even know they came in pink varieties.
Yes, the Pink Rathian is what I would call the final boss for kind of fledgling players. Like,
right.
You have your initial start, right? You have your initial monsters, mm-hmm. your low-ranking stuff, the initial story. And I would say the Pink Rathian is kind of your final test before the game throws right. you into what you might consider to be the actual end game, where you're fighting Elder Dragons and getting super high-level gear and everything. And, right. oh my god, that thing was a... He was kind of a jerk, Nadia. He was kind
of a Rathian,
jerk.
The Rathian is like the dragon wyvern things, right?
Yeah, the Rathian is basically a dragon with a poison tail.
Right. Right. So, yeah, I knew there was the red one. I knew, like, the females are kind of greenish, but I didn't know they were pink. That sounds very pretty.
Yes, but the thing is, a total jerk, and I felt like I was in a battle to the death. It reminded me of the battle in Evangelion, which I'm watching for whatever reason. yeah, I'm watching Evangelion again. There's a battle where this basically unstoppable angel has actually stomped into Nerve headquarters, and it looks like all is lost, but then Shinji finally comes in, and it's just this brutal knockdown, all-out, drag-out battle, which includes at one point them battling all the way over to the catapult, and then they launch them into the air and everything, and that's kind of how I felt when I was fighting that thing. It was just completely holding absolutely nothing back, like flying through mm-hmm. the air, crashing through platforms. It was epic.
It was as
epic a battle as I've ever had, ever in a game, period.
What weapon were you using?
I used a longsword. I was initially using the charge axe. I think we were talking about this before, but mm-hmm. I like the charge axe, or the charge sword, sorry, that became this. But then I discovered that everybody was using it, and so I decided
That's usually a good indication.
Yeah, exactly. So I decided to go with the longsword instead. Mm-hmm. And it's been a little bit challenging to learn, but now that I've learned it, I've come to really enjoy it. And it's really satisfying when you're using it properly. Go in and just do this giant slash and have the Wrathian go...
I started with the longsword, but I was like, it's a little too slow for me. That's why I switched to the dual blades.
It feels slow until you start to get the hang of it. And right. then it's because you have to understand that there's this little charge meter.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it works is you charge it up and then you hit R2 to do a really fast slashing combo.
Right.
And then you get it, and if you can complete that combo, it turns white, and then you feel it again, and then you do that again, and basically your goal is to get it all the way up to red.
Right.
And you can also do this rad charging attack that becomes this flying up into the air and then crashing down kind of thing that's, I'm trying to think, it's like Kirby's attack in Smash Brothers.
Oh, yes, the sword one, where he kind of spins and...
flies up into the air, comes back down, and shoots that's basically
that's
what it was
cool.
in Monster Hunter World. Yeah, so.
So that's yeah, like so, practice makes perfect.
Yeah, and I soloed it. I fought it by myself, because I've been trying to bring in people, but they kept dying. And finally, in the end, I felt like I knew what I needed to do. I knew where I needed to stand to be able to get it. And I was able to just land so many fantastic hits, but it was also landing fantastic hits, and I was flying around.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. I really want to go back to Monster Hunter World, but as we'll talk about later, as I've been playing Secret of Mana, so
yes.
And plus I've been in Japan, which is so we can't really take the PlayStation 4 on the plane with you.
No, exactly. So yeah, you should go read the article, which is titled "The Monster Hunter World's Pink Karathian Was My White Whale," which it was.
Except it was at least, pink, and it was a dragon.
At least for this, at least for the past couple weeks, because I found it to be a bit of a bottleneck, and I kind of explain why. But yeah, go read that article. It was, oh my god, it was so much fun. It was so satisfying to take that sucker down.
Yeah, it sound fun, so.
Yeah. On Twitter, I posted a relatively famous GIF from football, which is of the Washington's quarterback, Kirk Cousins, running down the hallway screaming, "You like that? You like that?"
I know.
Which he did after he had a huge comeback against. I was just so amped up after I took that down. Oh, nice. I'm fanning myself right now.
Take a cold shower.
Yeah, exactly. Last thing I want to highlight went up on Monday was my Xenogears retrospective, which, yeah, it was interesting going back and revisiting that one, Nadia, and just kind of learning about all the crazy history behind it and really how in over their head Tetsuya Takahashi and Soryu Saga and their team really was in making this freaking monster, because they were a small team with not a lot of resources, and he wanted
ambitions.
to make the most epic of epic RPGs freaking ever.
And kind of got there.
Yeah, he almost killed him.
Jeez.
Yeah, like had hair falling out and stuff.
Oh, that's so sad.
And almost killed Mitsuda too. It was ridiculous. Oh my gosh.
When I think of people dying for the games, even if we love those games so much and they're classics, and like, oh yeah, I nearly died making this. It's like, dude, I feel so bad now.
Yeah, it was interesting to go back and remember everything. Like, I had totally forgotten that Soylent Green is there's a major Soylent Green aspect to it. I had remembered the fact that Faye and another character were basically Adam and Eve and had been resurrected multiple times, but I had forgotten like the entire thread of how everything that goes on and the leader of the Empire that's conducting secret experiments and wants to elevate himself and yada yada yada. It's crazy, but
it really is the JRPG to end all JRPGs plot wise.
But the main thrust of the retrospective was a lot of the main thrust of the retrospective was ambition, the desire to tell these massive stories, to delve into territory that had never really been covered before.
Right.
That was kind of spurred on by the rise of stuff like Evangelion, which came out maybe a year before Xenogears properly started production. And
a little inspired.
How Final Fantasy VII and Xenogears were inextricably bonded, and then ultimately why Xenogears still really resonates today, because it really does resonate.
Like we were talking about it on Twitter, and people were just saying how much they still love Xenogears.
Even for people who weren't there, as it were, I think it, the fact that it's this kind of flawed but fascinating game that has the highest highs and the lowest lows really just kind of stands out to people, and the fact that really, we don't make games like that too often anymore.
No, we really don't. That was really when, like, RPG developers were realizing, wow, we have all the space we could want, even though it was still kind of a small amount of space when you think about it in today's terms. But when you're coming off a time period when you had to actually be mindful of how much text you had in a game because of space limitations, and then, like, wow, now you can have a literal novel as a story if you want it to happen. That had to be kind of liberating, kind of intimidating, and obviously some developers got in over their heads just a bit.
Yeah, like Tetsuya Takahashi.
Yes.
Anyway, go read that article. All right, but let's talk about some of the stuff in hand. So we'll start with Nadia.
Mm-hmm.
Nadia, you were playing the Secret of Mana remake over the week. Secret of Mana remake, I believe, is out now, or at least the reviews are out.
It's out.
And the consensus seems to be that it's pretty disappointing.
Consensus seems to be mixed, really. I know our own Jeremy Parrish was really not a fan. I think IGN kind of has the same viewpoint I do, where that it's actually a good, fun game on its own and very enjoyable. But if you're looking at it from the angle of a remake of Secret of Mana, it is disappointing because, as we've talked about in the past, the original Secret of Mana had a lot of blank spaces and problems that could be filled and could be fixed. And the remake doesn't really fix too many of those, or doesn't really fill in too many of the blanks. So that's why it's a little bit underwhelming for me, but I'm still really enjoying it. Like, I haven't finished it, but I'm looking forward to visiting, like, my favorite locations in the game, and I'm not disgusted by any means, put it that way.
Parrish really didn't like that game.
He did not like it.
He made an interesting observation. He said that the fact that the monsters can now attack in 360 degrees rather than just straight ahead or left or right or up, like, really messes things up, because now ranged enemies are a complete nightmare. are you finding that?
I know what he means by a 360 degree issue. That was me saying to myself, okay, I have to forget what I know about the original Secret of Mana and just kind of readapt to what this weird 3D world is. And once I did that, I was fine. I think I'm beginning to think that there was a compromise, too, with the bosses. I find they're a lot easier now, especially to hit with your weapons. You don't have to, like, just spam them with magic, which is what you had to do in the first game. But maybe I haven't come up against too many ranged enemies yet, but I haven't noticed any particular problems with them yet. But all ranged enemies were also... they were a nightmare in the first game. Like, you couldn't avoid their attacks, like, 75% of the time.
Yeah. And Parrish was also alluding to some very interesting remixes, which you also alluded to in Slack.
Yeah, there are accordions.
What?
Yeah, you know the opening song, the official title is Into the Thick of It. It's one of my favorite pieces of video game music. It's just really relaxing, flute-based melody that's just very calm. They'd remixed that and added accordions for some reason. I'm like, okay, all right. But I have noticed that there are some pieces that were remixed that I actually like a lot. So the soundtrack's not a total disaster. And either way, you can switch back and forth, like, between the old one and the new one pretty easily if you want.
Yeah, that was the impression. Well, that's what I found. And you could also have Japanese language and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I put on Japanese voices, like, right away. I have to be honest. Not that the English ones are terrible, just I felt more comfortable with the Japanese ones because there was a lot of yelling and hooing and hawing, and somehow that comes off as a lot more grating in English to me.
One of the things that you were kind of observing was, like, that you were disappointed that they didn't take, say, what was it, the Moon Palace?
Yeah.
And dramatically expand upon it. It's funny to me that that was the one that they demoed to me when they actually showed it to me. And
that is so funny.
That's a weird choice something to demo. I don't know why you would want to show that off. I guess it's because it's very brief.
It sure is. I was surprised when you told me that, because, I mean, I haven't reached the Moon Palace myself yet, but I remember what you had told me about the Moon Palace, and I said, well, if they haven't fixed the Moon Palace, they haven't fixed any of the kind of open areas of the game that really could use a little bit of filling. So it really is kind of a one-to-one, for the most part, a one-to-one remake of the game, which, for better or for worse, that's what it is.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know, it gets down to what you want out of a remake like this.
Yeah.
Do you want, I mean, I think the ideal example of a remake would be to come in and greatly expand upon the source material so that's why it should exist. If you look at Shadow of the Colossus for the PS4, its main reason for being was to take what was originally in the PS2 version and fully bring it in to the current generation. And you could argue with the results. I've seen plenty of people who are frustrated by the fact that they got rid of the grain, that it looks, that it's lost some of the stylization, that it looks, quote unquote, too much like a video game, that it doesn't use Bloom in the same way. But there are plenty of other people who are like, wow, this is like, I can finally experience Shadow of the Colossus and it looks magnificent, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and they also opened a door that had never been opened previously.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, you can get... there's a new subquest that can result in you getting a special sword.
Oh, that's cool. But it's actually an interesting point that you bring up, Shadow of the Colossus, because I think a lot of the same feelings apply here. One thing I mentioned is in my review is that, or my impressions rather, is that to really kind of enjoy the Secret of Mana remake, I had to let go of Secret of Mana on the SNES, which is a game I've played innumerable times. I know every enemy, I know every movement, I know every piece of music. So, of course, I'm just naturally going to rebel against this new thing that Square Enix has done. So I had to say to myself, okay, let's be objective about this. Is this a bad game? No, it is actually a really good little action RPG. Does it have its flaws? Yes, but a lot of those flaws were in the original Secret of Mana, and that's why, if the remake disappoints, that's why, because it doesn't fix those flaws. So if I'm going to admit, if I'm going to say, oh, the Secret of Mana remake is terrible, I'm basically going to have to say, oh, well, that means the original Secret of Mana is terrible, which is not. It's a fantastic game with problems, and I guess that's what the remake is, too.
It strikes me as a missed opportunity to really expand upon the source material, because everybody always just talks about the Secret of Mana remake, or the original Secret of Mana, as this game that's admittedly great, but could have been so much more.
Yeah.
And what could have been if it had been on the SNES CD and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I can't believe that they took this classic and went through the trouble of putting it in a new engine, essentially. I mean, they were using the Adventures of Mana engine or something to that effect, and didn't really kind of tackle it full on. And I guess that's down to Square kind of going, whatever, we'll make some money off this. We'll throw you a little bit of a budget. Have fun.
Yeah, exactly. It is definitely a budget game. There are certain areas where that's painfully obvious. I actually have let the graphic grow on me a bit. I find the character models, or rather the enemy models, are actually, some of them are really cute. The bosses, I think they look really good. The environments are okay. But there's still moments in the animation itself where you're like, wow, that looks so cheap. Why would you do that? For example, when they try to enter a cannon, like for the cannon travel center, they don't actually enter the cannon. They kind of go behind it, and that's an illusion that worked in 2D okay, but it really doesn't work in 2.5D.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
It really is. And their voice, their mouths don't move in the cutscenes, and that drives me up the wall. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
If you're gonna spend for full-on voice acting, because, I mean, even the NPCs in this game voice act, all of them, every random schmo in any town will have a voice, but you don't want to give me, the barest minimum of moving mouths? You're going to make me stare at their hanging open gobs? It's just so weird.
I think that it's the same problem that the Tokyo RPG Factory is facing.
Exactly, yes.
Which is, Square Enix wants to cash in on this nostalgia, but they're not willing to spend on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that, and I guess they see Secret, the Mana series, as a third or fourth tier property, and maybe it is, but it does have kind of the full weight of nostalgia behind it, which is evidenced by the fact that this game is getting coverage at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
It wouldn't have gotten coverage if it were a lot of other games. I mean, there was a remake that came out on the Nintendo Switch not too long ago, right?
Yeah.
And that game got barely any coverage at all because most people aren't super familiar with it. But people know Secret of Mana. They sure do know that game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I get that you have to pick your battles.
Yeah.
But if you're going to go through the trouble, I don't know why you wouldn't kind of go all out and actually make it a much bigger deal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not asking for a AAA game here. Just, some indication that that Secret of Mana fans are very passionate. They might be a small group, but they know what they like, that's for sure.
Here's an idea. Make it a AAA game.
Now, that would be interesting.
You need new IPs, right?
Yeah.
Bring the Mana series into the AAA space, go all out on it, and kind of hedge your bets by making it a remake of Secret of Mana. A full-on remake. I mean, I have to believe that there would be a pretty solid market for it. I mean, would it be the market that Square Enix would want? Would it sell 10 million copies? I don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that it would have a heck of a lot of word of mouth behind it. I know
that
people would see it as kind of a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if it was, like, impressive to look at, then it would turn heads, and you'd probably get some new fans that way.
Well, what do I know? I'm just some... there's a reason that I'm a journalist and not, you know, actually calling the shots. It's, we should make Secret of Mana, but it's a AAA game with a AAA budget and a AAA marketing budget. And
then we
the executives are just looking at me like, what? What are you even talking about?
Okay, that's very nice, Kat. Okay, we'll get right on that. And then they go back to whatever they're doing.
I'm sure that this will make Square Enix at least some money. It just...
Yeah.
If they're really trying to test the waters and see if there's a market for the Mana series, this is a weird way to do it.
It really is. I agree. But if you ask me, should I buy it? I'd say sure. Give it a shot. If you're a Mana fan, you have an open mind about it. And even if you just want a good, solid action RPG with actually, like, even though I am kind of reminded of Tokyo RPG Factory with the visuals at the same time, I think Secret of Mana, the remake, still does have a lot more personality visually than those other than Lost Sphere and I Am Setsuna. So it's a worthy investment. It's a good way to spend some time.
I'm going to disagree with you, Nadia.
Are you now?
I'm going to say don't buy it. Don't support this. Instead, buy an SNES Mini and play Secret of Mana on your TV. And also... numerous other high-quality Super Nintendo games.
Well, buy an SNES Classic anyway, because it's fantastic.
Yes. Secret of Mana is better in the original 16-bit form. It looks better. And maybe Secret of Mana Remake changes some things, improves some things in terms of the bosses, but not enough to sacrifice the classic look and feel of the original.
Okay, that's fair. But ideally, do both.
Why not both? Because we have budgets, Nadia. We can't be all as rich as you living over there in Toronto.
Yeah, I'm really loaded, let me tell you.
Yeah, money bags, Nadia. All right. So I've been playing another game, a game that has been getting some coverage around the internets. It's called Kingdom Come Deliverance, an RPG that... I want to say it was fairly controversial going in, but seems to have been getting a fair amount of positive press. It's a really interesting case because, so if you're not familiar with it, it is a RPG that is ostensibly about 15th century Bohemia, specifically what we would now know as the Czech Republic, and the events that happened there. And you'll forgive me, there are a lot of names going on here, but it opens with the son of a very successful king basically being a layabout who abuses his powers, and then the nobles appealed to a neighboring king who was related to him to come in and help, and that king just rolls in with his army and basically is like, hi, I live here now. This is my place. Hi. So when the game opens, that king is marauding, that leader, ruler is marauding around, attacking various areas, including the area of our main hero, who is a guy named Henry, who is a son of a blacksmith, who is apparently a master blacksmith at one point in another life, but has settled down into obscurity in some village. He's making a really nice sword for a lord. You're helping him out. Mm-hmm. And you kind of sound like a peasant from Warcraft 2.
I can't remember what the peasants sound like. Okay, I remember now. They had that.
What?
Yeah, what? Hold on. Those are the guys.
Hold on.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's pretty much what he sounds like. What is it? Leave me alone. That's pretty much what he sounds like.
Aren't they, like, European? Aren't they supposed to sound like... Well, I mean, my grandmother's Hungarian, and they have a very unique accent to them, but...
The only people who sound like they have an accent is early on in the game, you're walking through your village and there's this German, and he's called literally the Deutsch or the German. Uh-huh. And he has a pronounced German accent to highlight that he is different from everybody else. Uh-huh. So, yes. So pretty early on, Your village is attacked. There is much much pillaging. It's well, it's a scene, and you have to make a break for it, and you head to a neighboring castle, and that. But eventually, you try to return to your village to bury your, give your parents a Christian burial, mm-hmm. and that is where the story really begins. So it's hard to say, know where to begin with this game. I wrote an article on the site where I was kind of like, you know, the realism in this game feels a tiny bit contrived. Mm-hmm. I commented that I felt like I was piloting Henry like a robot.
I read that. I don't know if you specified an Eva, but you did mention a robot of some kind.
The image that came to mind was in Men in Black, the little creature that's inside the jewelry person's head.
Yes.
Yes.
That's adorable.
That was me. I'm that person, and I'm piloting Henry, like, I'm pulling all of the levers, watching all the gauges.
The lever for hunger, the lever for thirst.
Now, let me tell you, the stuff that Kingdom Come is not unique, because Fallout New Vegas basically has that stuff. Things like having to eat.
Right.
And that sort of thing. It's a lot more pronounced in Kingdom Come, and is actually like kind of annoying. It's kind of actually kind of immersion breaking at points, because you have to be constantly aware of it. So I'm not focusing on the actual experience of the game. I'm thinking about all of that different stuff. But more to the point, like, the game seems really set on having you do a lot of busy work, which seems to be designed to put you in the moment, I suppose.
Busy work is busy work. I did see you mention just how the hunger meter really kind of pesters you over and over, and really kind of puts a damper on the whole experience. And I was thinking about that, because I haven't played Kingdom Come myself, but just thinking about how people feel hunger versus how they feel thirst. I mean, you can feel hunger, but it can actually, you can live for quite a long time without food. And I was wondering, in Kingdom Come, like, will you, like, dwindle to nothingness if you, like, in record time, if you leave it be?
If you're hungry, you'll be swaying back and forth, and the game will be like, I'm so hungry. Ooh, I need to eat some food, my lord. No, and if you're tired, like, the camera will kind of blink in and out. Like,
I'm
exhausted. It's not as that bad, per se. I mean, like, I had a rather large meal, and then I was able to pretty much make do. I actually overate. And then I was like, you are now sluggish and slow, and you won't be able to do as many things. And I was like, oh, well, okay, well, that's fine, I suppose.
Go for a jog.
Your character is very lazy, spends a lot of time sleeping, actually. Like, the very first time you see your character, he's oversleeping.
So, you know, this guy's sounding like a JRPG hero. He's an orphan from a small village, and his father was a famous blacksmith who was retired to a quiet life. And he likes to sleep.
And yeah, that's the funny thing, is that this game actually is not that different from your fairly standard RPG tropes. Mm-hmm. It feels like kind of a throwback in that regard, in terms of how it presents its characters and everything. The only difference is that it's ostensibly couched in real history, which I think is kind of the draw of this thing. You can debate on how accurate that history is. I know that I've seen some people, there have certainly been some disagreements on, for example, how it portrays people of color. Rock, Paper, Shotgun called out the fact that it mostly portrays Turks as kind of like these savage raiders and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think I read that article.
The game has a codex that, like, just to drive it home, the game has a freaking codex that says, women in the Middle Ages, women didn't do anything. Men were in charge. Deal with it. It doesn't actually say that, but it says, Middle Ages were a strictly patriarchal society, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, okay, I get it. Fine, cool, whatever. Fine. Like, most of the women kind of remind me, you know, like how they act in video games in general. You know, you have the kind of the motherly figures, and you have, you know, prostitutes.
Yeah, yeah.
As the prologue comes to an end, you're fighting some bandits, and the bandit gets the best of you, and, like, a woman shows up, and she yells, an obscenity and points at him, and then a whole like load of horses come rolling in. I'm like, I like that lady.
That's pretty cool. I want to be the horse lady.
Yeah, she's badass. All right. So, I mean, she wasn't on the horse. She was just still, she just kind of runs better. Up, and then the horses come in behind her.
Wow. So it's just like, okay, I do respect the idea of what they were trying to go for in terms of a historically accurate game, but with things like the horse lady just summoning horses, like it's a freaking
she didn't
offense.
Summon horses.
I'm just saying, you're making it sound like she summoned horses to
No, she brought people. She brought in reinforcements.
Oh, okay. Were people?
She didn't literally
horses.
Summon horses.
Were people on the horses? Or
yes, people were on horses coming in from behind her.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, you're in like a village that's been completely burned out. It's full of corpses and everything.
Okay.
Yeah. So, a few thoughts really quickly. I do think the combat is actually decent so far. I like the way that you can attack from different sides, mm-hmm. and you're going for the parts that are kind of not armored, and right. you can stab. And if you can kind of stab through a helmet, you can like put it right into their face, and they're dead.
They're not
dead.
Like that.
Yeah. And they're gonna block your just basic blows, so you got to mm-hmm. kind of chain them together,
right.
without running down your endurance. That's cool.
Yeah, because you can get tired of here, right? If you overextend yourself.
I don't know if you know this, but I do like history quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I listen to podcasts like Hardcore History. I have freaking Winston Churchill's 5-part volume on World War II, and I even read most of it. like history's always been kind of my jam. Mm-hmm. More recent history, especially like 19th century, 20th right. century, that kind of thing. But yeah, I'm down. I'm down with the histories. Not as much medieval history, but I'm down with it. And it strikes me that this game has kind of an old-fashioned take on history. And mm-hmm. what I mean by that is that our old-fashioned way of looking at history is basically to focus on the so-called great man, right? Like
right.
gods and kings, right?
Right, right.
Everything is shaped by these great men who arise and lead nations, right? Mm-hmm. And a more modern view is something what we might call like trends and forces,
right.
that lots of different forces act on different things, migrating populations, disease, whatever, and that's what gives rise to history.
Right.
It's more of a bottom-up than a top-down kind of approach.
Right.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So what you're saying is Kingdom Come is really more of that old-fashioned one man makes all the difference sort of thing.
A little bit. Just in the sense of, from the very beginning, you're a peasant and you're living in this village, and everybody seems very concerned at all times about what the king is doing and talking about mm-hmm. the king and king this, king that. Oh, go respect the king. Let us debate politics and grand things. And it feels like something that someone who is really into history or really into that particular period would say.
Right.
Right? Like
right.
they would put those words into the person's mouth. And
right.
look, I didn't live in 15th century Bohemia, so I don't know what they talked about. But I imagine most of it was, I'm working.
I was going to say, like, how's the
I got fields to plow. I gotta make this sword. work.
Have you ever
seen,
I think it's Eric Idle, who kind of did a whole miniseries on peasants and how people lived in mm-hmm. medieval England. And it was very much what you say, whereas we think they talk constantly about their oppression and the kings and the lords and how terrible things were. They were just people living pretty normal lives, complaining about the same junk we do.
Yeah, I mean, there's the stairway, I can't ever remember, the kind of the levels of need. Mm-hmm. So at the very basic level is, I'm hungry. Okay, now I have eaten. All right, now I need to be able to sustain myself and like have a job. Okay,
right.
I can do that. And you just keep moving up on the levels until eventually you have wisdom, because you have time to have wisdom. You have
exactly.
time to think about your problems. And peasants at a very basic level are going, I need to feed myself.
Yeah.
I need to not die.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's weird to be wandering around the village and have people like actually care about politics.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's how it was. maybe people were concerned with what the king was doing, but that stood out to me, if you know what I mean. And that strikes me as just a thing with video games. I don't know if you can easily make an RPG, say, that really captures life in a world, because so much of being an RPG is having a hero protagonist.
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be hard to really make that wider range of vision happen in an RPG.
Yeah, it's like hard to imagine the son of a blacksmith falling in with a lord and eventually rising up to become a knight and a great warrior and like having, you know, playing out this kind of role, right?
Yeah.
They're a freaking peasant.
Yeah.
The game specifically states that people have stations in their lives, right?
Yeah, exactly. And peasants didn't really move up in the world very frequently.
They didn't move beyond their station. And
they were peasants.
Yeah, exactly. But in this game, it's going to make allotments for that because you're the hero. You're kind of a dork. I mean, you have to get your armor by stealing it, but still.
Hey, you still got it.
Exactly. So I think the point is that that might be a limitation of the medium.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I definitely see where you're coming from in that this is a game that kind of contradicts itself a little bit. It can't really help it because, again, that's the limitations of the medium. But yeah, I definitely agree with your piece. I see where you're coming from.
Or in the sense of maybe not the limitations of the media, but the limitations of the RPG genre as we know it. Because it's a little it's a little freaking boring to play as a peasant who's just doing their daily chores, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, hear the other peasants talk about, oh, I have a horse. I have two horses, you know, or whatever the hell peasants talked about back then. I understand why Warhorse went for the whole, like, do you hear the king is, like, you know, fucking around sort of thing.
But conversely, I think an adventure game could do a pretty good historical thing, right?
Yeah.
A friend of mine is making a mobile game set during the French Revolution.
That's fun.
About the fashion of the French Revolution. And
that's cool.
That's a very ground up kind of thing, right? So I think different genres can tackle it in different ways, and that's maybe the strength of video games, is that you can have so many different formats, right? So many different ways to tell the story. But RPGs, as we know them, are, you know, they're a very particular genre. And so I guess that you could be a knight and everything, but you're just going to inevitably maybe fall a little bit into this very old-fashioned way of kind of telling a story. And maybe that's why we haven't had historical RPGs as we know them in the past. Maybe that's why we have your typical, medieval fantasy. Why,
right.
Maybe that's why we've gone in that direction, because it's more fun to fight dragons than than to try and be as historically realistic as humanly possible.
Although there's obviously an audience for that, the realism.
Well, yeah, it's obviously really novel, and plus the game has achieved a certain amount of notoriety, so it's going to have its boosters, and there's always going to be people who are like, I want a game that's as realistic as possible.
Yeah.
Even if it's a game where I get the ale for my father and I stood around for too long and it went warm and I had to go back and get the freaking ale and bring it back to the father again for no goddamn reason.
Did he yell at you? Well, I'm not.
Yeah, he yelled at me. Oh, I'm not drinking that ale. Go get more ale. Do it again.
It's a 15th century pops. Take what you can get.
Yeah. I think the game could have cut down on the busy work is what I'm saying.
Right.
So it's weird things like I'm standing on the battle, like, we've just had a kind of a dramatic moment where the army rides up. It's very tense. And you're like, oh, man, are they going to attack? Are they going to attack the castle that I've holed up in? And they, like, ride off. And you're like, okay. And they're like, well, stand guard on the battlements now. And I'm like, okay, I'm standing guard on the battlements. Now what do I do? Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. I'm standing guard. Am I supposed to be doing anything? And then I go downstairs, and the guard stops me. He's like, oh, first time being a guard on the battlements, eh? Well, just lean over on that wall over there, and you can wait until morning. And I'm like, okay, so I was supposed to wait using a little timer. Okay, I gotcha.
Right.
All right, fine.
On the job.
Yeah. And then the whole lockpicking thing. Don't even get me started on the lockpicking.
Yeah,
interesting game. Kind of boring. Not gonna lie, but I'm gonna keep on it just because. Like, freaking sold 500,000 copies. It's kind of the discussion of the moment, and I'll keep pressing on it. I'd rather be fighting dragons in Monster Hunter World, but that's how it goes. All right, speaking of other games that we're playing right now, Nadia, it's time after a week off to get back to the Cosmic Star Harrowrun Report.
No, I've been having a good time with it, although one thing I think we're going to be talking about is battles that go on a bit too long.
Yeah, I suppose so. We haven't gotten too much further than we were a couple weeks ago, because we've had other projects going on, for example, Kingdom Come and Monster Hunter World, but... So, the last time we talked, we were in jail.
Yeah.
And we were escaping jail from prison. And we were doing that whole thing. And then we were fighting the mafia. Yeah, it was like, you know what it kind of reminded me of, Nadia?
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of a piece of the action from Star Trek. Did you ever see that episode? Did you ever watch Star Trek?
I watched Star Trek, a little bit. My parents were big fans of Next Generation. Actually, my father was a big fan of the original, too. So I watched, like, through osmosis, but I never really watched it, like, dedicated, sat down, and said, I'm going to watch Star Trek.
It's the original series. Basically, there was a planet. A book was left behind called Chicago Gangsters of the 20s. The planet finds the book, models their entire society after it. Now you have gangsters, a gangster planet. And cool. That's the famous Kirk Spock gangster episode. Well, there was a Star Trek video game, Star Trek 25th Anniversary for the NES, where you return to that planet because McCoy accidentally leaves his communicator on that planet at the end of the episode. They get hold of this communicator, and I guess they're able to create like a temporal vortex or something like that and destroy their society. So you got to go down and get the communicator back to save the planet.
Wow, those communicators are dangerous.
I know, right? That's crazy. Yeah, so basically what I'm saying is that it reminds me of this. When it's like, we went from Firefly to gangsters.
Yeah, we sure did.
You had to prove that the mafia was helping out, I don't know, local crime lord or something like that.
Yeah.
And hey, look, there's the mafia. Cool.
And there's a casino. All right.
Yeah, no, you're like in a casino. It's very alien casino, maybe a little bit like The Last Jedi, and you're fighting the mafia. And at this point, like, I hadn't played in a bit, and I was like, yeah, I don't know what I'm doing, but yeah, I sure am running through this casino, fighting. So there's the mafia guys. Okay, I'm fighting the mafia guys. There were like five guys to fight.
Yeah, the boss battle was like four mooks and one guy who was pretty strong.
Yeah, and you have to take out the guy. Even if you take out the guy who's pretty strong, you have to take out the mooks.
But yeah,
let's see, at this point I had so at this point I had Alyssa, I had Sue, I had Lauren, and I had Clark the robot.
I
had a fair amount of area of effect attacks that made it relatively easy for me to hit a good chunk of the screen. Lauren had this tornado attack, for example, which covered a very wide area and did a fair amount of damage to all of them. So, yeah, I wasn't having any trouble. Did you have any trouble with them?
Not with the bosses. Where I was having trouble was just the regular encounters. I found, just because there was some of the enemies had like 4,000 or more hit points, and that can take quite a lot of time to whittle down. I thought at first maybe they were just so high leveled because they wanted you. The game wanted you to use Clark, because Clark, as you mentioned in the last episode we talked about Cosmic Star Heroine, Clark can blow himself up to great benefit to your party. So, used correctly, Clark can actually shorten a battle by quite a bit, but it just looks like that's the tone the game is taking from there on, that these enemies are actually small boss encounters half the time.
Yeah, and this is a fairly common thing in the Z-Boy games, especially, they did that in the Penny Arcade games as well, where they made the encounters very curated and almost like puzzles, which, certainly a valid creative approach, I suppose. But and the subject of Clark, really quickly, I'm not entirely convinced that he's actually that strong.
But he's a sexy pelvis-thrusting robot, all right, isn't he?
I think one of the problems with him is, so he can raise your style a lot.
Yes.
And he can do some damage, and he has an ability that will make it so that whatever his next attack is isn't going to isn't going to kill him.
Yeah, save him.
So you can have him do the self-destruct that will do a lot of damage to one enemy, like about 1,000 damage. Or you can have him do the attack that will heal everybody. The problem is that it requires setup.
They do. And I find that, if I'm not mistaken, his hyper is random. So you never quite know what to expect from him.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think even his self-destruct is a lot stronger if he's hyper.
Seems like a little bit of a joke character.
Kind of the Dan of Cosmic Sour Heroine.
Well, I think the problem, I mean, he's meant to be funny, right?
He is funny.
He is a funny character. Clark is funny.
Yeah.
He's a disco robot, Disco Clark. And, but the thing is that if he's dead, then that's one less character who is helping your party. And I guess you could set it up so that he just uses his attack and then Chan can say, bring him back to life with a revival.
But then she has to use up one of her turns. And if she's like in hyper and you want to use her for an attack, it's a bit of a hassle.
Yeah, he has to. Well, I have Chan being basically pure healing.
Oh, really? I have her as mostly an attacker and a little bit of defense, too.
Yeah, I have her. I have all of the healing stuff on her. Mm-hmm. And plus just maybe one or two attacking spells. And she is an excellent support character.
She's got some pretty good balance. Not as good as Alyssa, but she is quite good.
Oh, Alyssa can do everything, is the thing.
Yeah, Alyssa's great.
Yeah, but Chan can really heal the entire party very effectively. And so it's unclear what Clark's strength is. He's kind of a little bit of everything. I guess he can raise your style. He can heal a little bit. He can do some damage. He can do some area of effect attacks. But I've never found that he provided the bang for the buck that I wanted in my party, and I wasn't really willing to build my entire party around him.
Yeah, I kind of boot him out of my party as soon as I could, to be honest with you. He can also steal, but I find that I'm not having a problem finding credits, so I don't really use a steal attack.
I have all the credits I could ever need.
Yeah,
much.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was able to, every time I come upon a shop, I'm basically able to buy it out. I'm pretty happy with the shields and the equipment that I have on my characters at the moment, so I don't feel any special need to upgrade them or buy new ones.
Yeah, that's one interesting thing about Cosmic Star Heroine is the shields, sometimes they can give you a better defense boost, but every shield has kind of an after effect or skills that may be more handy on some people than others. Like, if you get like a shield that has some fantastic attack and you don't have the hackatoo to use it, what's the point?
Yeah, exactly. You have to be very careful about what you put on.
Yeah.
With Alyssa, I put the super burst attack shield on her, the one that lets her combine with other characters to do a super attack.
Oh, I haven't tried that one.
Oh, it's really good.
Oh, that's cool.
Because the attacks that she does with them are super strong. So, especially if like, if you have a Reet in your party, they will do a massive area attack that takes out everybody without any question, because it doesn't even have the little circles. It just whole screen.
Everyone goes down.
With Sue, like, she does a really powerful physical attack. With Lauren, they have Duet.
That's cool.
And that will cause regen to start on your party.
Right.
And I think also some healing. So I think it's essential. Like, you have to have it because it boosts her attack so strong, so much.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, once I got a chance to swap in my characters again, I went back to Alyssa, Chan, Sue, and Arete because they're just really good. And I find that they cover almost all of the bases. I don't have lightning and I don't have wind covered, but I have ice, fire, earth, and ice, fire, earth, and water, and that alone is a pretty solid range of everything.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, I have Lauren instead of Arete, so I just like Lauren.
Lauren's really good, actually.
I find she has a pain song, which is like kind of like a really strong poison attack of sorts that you can use against enemies. That's really good for whittling them down.
The Pain Song is excellent. The Tornado attack is excellent. Just the fact that right at the beginning of the battle, she does a free, like, 1,000 damage.
Yeah, that's really handy.
Because she always goes first, and she starts with her in hyper mode. So
yes.
She just go in and smack him right in the face.
She has a move called microphoned, as in owned, but microphoned.
Is that the stun attack?
It's a stun attack, yeah. And a big microphone hits the enemies. It's pretty great.
Are you just using her because you are amused by the pun and you just like the idea of the microphone hitting the enemy?
No, I am amused by the mental image of the microphone hitting the enemies, but I'm not a pun person. They make me laugh, but I'm not necessarily impressed by them.
Yeah, so...
Except for microphone. I think that's great.
I get all of that with Elite, Arete as well, because her drones are always attacking.
Yeah.
And then she can also throw the ice vials. And plus, I have attached on... And plus, she has super high hackitude. So
yeah,
I have... I have a module attached to her that not only super boosts my party's attack, but also has a Molotov attack, which does massive fire damage.
You got the bases covered.
Yeah, I got all my bases covered with her. And I can just... everybody is noticeably stronger with her in there. And I don't know, they just... I found myself getting through encounters so much more quickly. Mm-hmm. Once I swapped over to Arete and had the Arete, Sue, Chan, and Alyssa combination. So,
maybe
yeah, that's kind of my...
I mean, go
with what you feel. I feel like this is a game that you can conceivably play with everybody, including Clark.
If you really want to give Clark that time and attention, sure. But
yeah, like Dave's good, too. Like, Dave is really good.
Dave has a lot of... Dave is really valuable against mechanical enemies.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when you're running into mechanical enemies and you can't poison them, you want Dave. I would even say that Dave and Lauren is an excellent combo because Dave can handle all the stuff that Lauren can't easily. And Lauren can handle all of the biological enemies.
Yeah, they make a good pair.
So after you take out the mafia guys, you head up into, I guess, what you would call a swamp. And now there are bug monsters.
Yeah,
and
it's nasty.
I've already... talked about this a little bit, but man, there's so much whiplash in this game because you go from Firefly, Wild West, Casino, Robots, Dark Tower, Mafia, Star Trek, Piece of the Action, to bugs in a swamp, bug creatures in a swamp, biomechanical
troopers.
Bugs. Yeah,
yeah.
It changes in a heartbeat. They're literally next door to one another. You don't even go to a different planet.
No, you don't. Although, I have to say, at least it keeps things interesting. Like, you never feel like you're in the same place for too long.
Yeah. I mean, we complain all the time about games that have the same bland environments over and over again. I'm looking at you, Mass Effect Andromeda. It's really nice to have a little bit of, I don't know, variability, I suppose.
Yeah. But... I mean, it keeps you on your toes because, of course, every region has a different way to fight, a different kind of enemy that you have to strategize your way around. Like, you were just talking about how you have biological enemies versus robot enemies, talking about two pretty different strategies there.
So you're going through a swamp, and you have to get these eyeballs, and one of the eyeballs can be found in a house with a robot, and you can either barter, threaten. Did you find the robot in the house, Nadia?
No, I do know the eyeballs you're talking about, but I haven't, that's where I stopped for now, I haven't bartered with the robot yet.
Yeah, you should try threatening him just to see what happens.
Okay, I'll do that. Even though it's kind of mean, I'll do it.
I want to know. I want to know what happens for science.
Okay.
I was also missing the other eyeball for a while, but it's in a flower.
Oh, okay.
And, like, it's right there, but it kind of blended into the environment a little bit.
Right.
So I was having a hard time finding it. It's what you need to extend the bridge. The encounters there are a bit longer, and that gets you into the bug village, if I recall correctly.
Okay,
Yeah. And then once you're in the bug village, you have to do this whole, like, song and dance where you talk to everybody, cardinal rule of RPGs, talk to all the people.
I thought you were talking about, like, a literal song and dance.
No,
just, like,
unfortunately.
Dance,
I mean, we've had that before with Lauren, but no literal song and dances. You have to talk to everybody to fix the thing and do the thing and get the thing, and then eventually you can go into the Hive Tower. And there's a great little cutscene when you go to the Hive Tower where it pans up like an NES game.
Oh, I love that.
Like Ninja Gaiden.
Ninja Gaiden, or I was thinking Mega Man 2 with the building.
yeah, I always, whenever I play Ninja Gaiden, I always love the moment when you climb to the top of the cliff and then suddenly it's like do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do- were like,
it's a very cinematic game for its time.
Yeah, I mean, it looked really awesome on the back of the box, right?
Yeah, that's true. A great box shot.
Yes, exactly. So, but yeah, so you have that kind of moment where it's panning up and you're looking up to the top of the tower. But, and the Hive Tower is actually relatively brief as well. But one thing that kind of has started to stand out at me, and we were talking about this earlier, Nadia, the actual enemy encounters, they take a while to get through, don't they?
They do. I do have to say one thing for them is once the enemies are gone, they're gone unless you exit the dungeon entirely and come back in. So if you have to backtrack for some reason, you won't come across the same enemies again. But they still do take a while to get through.
I think something that stands out to me that bothers me a slight bit is that there's not enough differentiation between the mobs and the bosses.
Yeah, I had noticed that when I was playing through the casino area.
Yeah, because you're... Because every time I would be fighting a mob, I basically spin up the same combo, which I can almost imagine it in my sleep. Like, it would be...
same.
Lauren, it would be go in, smack them with the initial attack, then have Alyssa do the do another turn, have her do that again to another enemy, and then it cuts over to Clark, who does the style attack... And then it cuts over to Sue, who does the counter. And then just on, I just do the same moves over and over and over again.
Yeah, I do think this is a game that could benefit from programming a cursor in there and letting it just kind of do its thing.
And I think that's the side effect of a state. One of the stated purposes of this game was, well, in so many RPGs, you are holding back on using abilities. Because you don't want to waste them. So many people don't use their potions, or they don't use their item expendables, or they don't use whatever because they're afraid that they're going to have them for a big moment or need them for a big moment, and then they never use them. So I want to make it so that you can use them in every battle. But the side effect of that is that you just do the same thing over and over again every time you fight an enemy party. And I mean, the game is pretty short, all things considered. Like, I'm 10 hours in, and I'm well over halfway finished. But it does... after a while, I would, like, get to an enemy and be like, all right, well, time to go through the cycle again, right?
The cycle of life and death.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know. Like, it's hard to say. It feels a little bit like a flaw to me. Like, I guess the enemy types are fairly different, but I don't even really feel that much of a need to acknowledge the different enemy types because I can just go through my cycle anyway, regardless.
Yeah, like, and I have a pretty solid strategy for, like, it's similar to yours, but I feel like I'd be like, I expect a certain amount of repetition from RPGs. That's fine. I'd be satisfied if the HP was a little bit lower.
Yeah, it takes a bit to get through,
drag on. And I don't know if the easy mode makes them weaker, but I don't really want to play in easy mode either, so meh.
Yeah. I think the main difference is if they're weak to ice, I will use the ice drone, and if they aren't weak to ice, I'll just use the drone that ignores defense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I'll do a fair amount of damage either way. And meanwhile, like, inevitably, somebody is going to have a fairly strong way to do a lot of damage. And I can just keep buffing up Sue until he's doing freaking 2,000 damage with one punch. So,
yes.
Or 4,000 damage, even if I manage to make them vulnerable. So it's kind of like, I don't know. I don't know what I would do different exactly. It's certainly a choice, but it kind of begs the question of, what do we want out of our mobs exactly?
Yeah. No, I understand that.
What's a good example, Nadia, in your opinion, of an RPG that just really nails the balance of making just the regular encounters interesting?
I'm going to go with the really easy cliche answer and say Chrono Trigger.
Okay, why?
I just always found that there, I think that the enemy, what I'm looking for, formations, always varied up enough between encounters that I really had to give some thought to, like, okay, am I going to use the Falcon Strike, which goes straight across, or am I going to use an Area of Effect attack, which gets everyone? And the enemies weren't so, they weren't meat shields. Like, they went down, like, at a reasonable clip, and not so quickly that they were a joke. And then, of course, you also have the fact they moved around, which could really change your strategy in a heartbeat.
Also, there were always really strong attacks that were being held in reserve in Chrono Trigger. Like, you could break out your triple techs or your really strong techs for much harder enemies, and you can get by on weaker attacks with the other stuff. And plus, the battles go by really fast for the most part.
They do, yeah. And you're right. Like, I never use my triple techs for regular encounters usually, but I use them all the time for bosses, and so that I didn't feel like anything was being wasted.
Yeah, and I sort of feel like another benefit of Chrono Trigger is that when you're fighting a boss, I mean, every boss requires vastly different different strategy, especially as you get much later into the game,
right.
and it really encourages you to vary up your party. And I haven't felt the need yet to vary up my party significantly. That might be because I'm not playing in the highest difficulty level,
right?
Which my understanding is the highest difficulty level is quite hard, mm-hmm. Actually, and you really have to put a lot of thought into your strategy. But I think that it can be a good thing to have a really kind of a good balance of that, even when you're playing on, say, the normal difficulty level, which is where a lot of people kind of fall.
Exactly. Like, I mean, let's be honest, Chrono Trigger is just one difficulty, and I feel like it's the perfect difficulty.
Yeah, I do too, actually. I think Chrono Trigger really nails that. A lot of people point to Persona as another great example of a game that makes its regular encounters pretty interesting, because the enemies can go down really fast, but they can also be extremely dangerous.
Yeah, I found that with 5 especially.
And this is a thing with SMT in general, is that the regular enemies all have their strengths and their weaknesses and their very particular ways of attacking.
Right.
And you see one, you go, oh, yeah, okay, I'll go after, I know what I need to do against this guy, or I know what I need to use against this guy. And it's a fairly simple rock, paper, scissors kind of elemental damage thing. But it, I mean, things like as simple as, will they buff up their other party members?
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
How fast do I need to take them down before they become a real legitimate threat to my party? Etc. How easy can I get it into my party? All this stuff that you have to be thinking about, while at the same time the encounters kind of fly by.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Persona 4 in particular, I found that I could not just... I'm very much a physical attacker in RPGs, but you can't do that in Persona games. You really do need your elemental attacks, and you need to use them. You won't be holding them in reserve.
Yeah, exactly. And then more on the kind of PC RPG kind of side of things, a good example of interesting mobs would be mobs that you can kind of engage whenever you want, and often drop good loot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you're like going, oh, yeah. So mobs that are relatively easy, interesting to fight, and are worthwhile to fight because they drop interesting stuff.
Yeah, I like that positive feedback loop.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even in Monster Hunter, you'll be running through and it'll be like, you'll suddenly see a pack of, I don't know, lizard things coming at you, and you go, well, I could ignore you, but I know that you've got some good loot.
Knife right? comes out.
Or knife even better, if, or going full Diablo.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, here comes a horde of enemies, but I am about to just nuke this entire room, and that feels really freaking good.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so the meat of this game is its regular encounters. Mm-hmm. And I want to say they're boring.
No,
because
they're just time-consuming.
A little bit. Yeah, no, and they kind of go slowly. And I'm using the same attacks on them, and I don't know if there is a more optimal way to be going about it. Yeah, it's strange. But I don't know what I would do differently in this case. But
yeah, same. I'll be experimenting a bit, see if anything comes up. But for now, I'm just doing what I'm doing.
Well, I feel like I've got my party down, right?
Right, exactly. Like, I feel like I can probably experiment a bit more. But I'm probably going to leave Clark on the sidelines. Poor guy.
Yeah. But I guess we'll have to see as we continue into what will hopefully be the last couple chapters of the Cosmic Star Heroine Report. All right, Nadia, as usual, we're going to go through and have some of the listener responses. Last week, of course, we were talking about multiple endings in RPGs and making meaningful decisions in RPGs. And Fallout, the original Fallout 1, naturally came up a bit.
Yeah.
St. Judas of Sleep said, "My own inclination is towards the type of endings that are determined by your actions throughout the course of a game. I still remember the feeling of surprise when my vault dweller shot the Overseer at the end of Fallout 1 instead of quietly accepting his destiny. As much as I love JRPGs, I'm usually a bit annoyed by the true ending model, requiring very specific actions and pathways. To me, multiple endings should be about multiple viable endings, mm-hmm. rather than a bunch of bad or so-so endings and only one true conclusion providing narrative closure." Yeah, I agree with that. I like the idea of having multiple viable endings.
Yeah, I feel Undertale really nailed that, because there are three very distinct endings and a bunch of, like, little variation endings, but those three distinct endings, the only way to really comprehend the entire story of the game is to get them all. And that genocide ending is not easy to get in any regard.
Flipsider99 says, "I am not a role player, so personally, meaningful endings just come from a good storytelling for me. I don't particularly care about a game providing meaningful decisions, and find that games that put too much of an emphasis of role-playing your own story tend to have less interesting stories than what I'm looking for."
Yeah, fair enough. I always just kind of like the... Sometimes it's like a happy ending. Like, I find Final Fantasy IV's ending is very cheesy, but very, very good in its conclusion. Just, it's pretty much what you expect happened, just happens. Everyone's friends, Rosa and Cecil get married. Hooray! Kane's an idiot.
I made a little bit of a mistake during that podcast, Nadia. So I highlighted Super Robot War Alpha Wars Alpha 3, and I said that if you let Ideon get too damaged or too hurt, the world would end.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the way that you get the universe ending, there is an ending where the universe ends in that game.
Wow,
and the way that you get that ending is you have to beat the game once, and then you have to get all the way to like mission 57, and then you do a particular pathway. And if you do that pathway, you will go down the end of the universe ending, where everybody just knows that the world is going to end, and you are basically kind of stuck, as it were. And then you get the ending from the movie Be Invoked, where basically the universe ends, but you see that that they a person has been reborn, and that there's life and death and rebirth and that kind of stuff. It's all very Buddhist, but
very dark. Yes,
my apologies for saying that wrong, but yes, there is an ending in Super Robot Wars Alpha 3 where you destroy the universe, so that's pretty rad.
That's one hell of a conclusion. Just like, you can destroy the bad guy, or you can destroy the universe. I'm going to go all the way in.
Muchan says, "So many things to talk about in this podcast. I tend to pick when I feel is the right choice and see how things go for me. Like with Witcher 3, I am a snarky guy but turns down money to poor people when I'm given the chance. I think one of the issues I have with the ending of Mass Effect is that you're pretty much doing the thing you were stopping in Mass Effect 1. So pretty much it's only okay when you're doing it because you're the hero, which feels weirdly wrong. I just couldn't enjoy it because I honestly hate the whole idea of Mass Effect. Humans are the newest race, but for some reason they are treated as pretty much gods and even given the highest office for no really good reason, just, well, it was meant to be, which never sat right with me."
Right.
As for, yeah. So, I mean, I agree with that. Humans being all special and stuff. I prefer the stories where humans are kind of insignificant.
Yeah, I think Master of Orion was like that, where humans were just like the boring all-around race, and the only thing that was really good about us is that we were easy to get along with, or, I don't know, manipulate, I guess.
Traitors.
Traitors, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
You got five fingers, you're dexterous, you're good.
Yeah, nothing special, squishy mammals living in a backwater planet.
Careless.
It's always humans with a special destiny, but we gotta feel like we're important, Nadia. Andrew... The Way 15 actually takes issue with Chrono Trigger's multiple endings.
That's interesting.
"On the historical examples, I'm less satisfied by Chrono Trigger's multiple endings as time goes on in terms of what they reflect to the main characters, and more in how the endings show the story of the land, its shifting territories, and how different groups handle the erosion of their homes over time.
I guess I see where he's coming from, but at the same time, I feel like Chrono Trigger's different endings were just so much part of his personality, especially since the endings varied wildly depending on what you did. Like, some were like credits rolls and they weren't really special, but gosh, the one with like Magus and Frog is just incredible. Or the one where Magus goes up against Lavos. And then, of course, Chrono Trigger, I don't know if it gave us New Game Plus, but it certainly popularized it.
And Nice Guy Neon says that Blood and Wine is the best Witcher game if you've played the whole series, because it's very standalone, but it's entirely connected to the original trilogy, and it just has an amazing ending.
I haven't seen that ending.
Well, I'll of course not, because you haven't played Witcher 3.
No, I haven't. I really need to.
Yeah, that's what we keep saying, but one day, one day, Nadia. All right, let's end this episode before I freaking hack a lung out. Axe of Blood God, US Gamer Podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Follow me on Twitter at @_catbot, Nadia at Nadia Oxford, and of course, all of the US Gamer accounts on Facebook, Twitter, Twitch. We stream every Tuesday and Thursday. And hey, Nadia, you are on another podcast. It's called the US Gamer Podcast. Tell me what that's all about.
Let's see. This week we talked about... my trip to Japan, of course, and we talked about, I can't remember what Katie was playing. I think she was playing Florence, and she talked a bit about that. And I'm really blanking on what our main
Kingdom Hearts 3.
Oh, yes, we talked about Kingdom Hearts 3, all right. That was the thing we talked about.
Exactly. We're talking about Kingdom Hearts 3 and all of that good stuff. So go check out that podcast. And as I said, we stream every Tuesday and Thursday. Next week, we'll be back as per usual for more podcasting goodness. Make sure, of course, to subscribe and tell your friends. If you are enjoying the podcast, leave us a review on iTunes. We love to hear your thoughts. We love to hear nice feedback and nice comments from you guys. And we do take all of that to heart. Even if you have some constructive feedback, please don't be a hater.
Yeah.
But otherwise, until next week, for Nani and myself, thanks for listening. Until then, happy adventuring.